Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
It looks like years of debates over the fate of Air National Guardsmen engaged in space missions are coming to an end. Air Force officials are now pushing to move National Guard space units into the Space Force. But that doesn't mean there will be a Space Force National Guard just yet. Federal News Network's Anastasia Obis sorts out what's going on here. And Anastasia, what do we know about the service's decision to move National Guard space units to the Space Force? What's actually going on here?
What we know so far is that the Air Force sent a draft legislative proposal to Congress to transfer all space units within the National Guard to the Space Force. The way they want to go about it is they want to bypass the existing law that requires them to get a governor's consent before making any changes to a National Guard unit and then transfer those units to the Space Force. Air Force top officials have been on the Hill for the past couple of weeks, and they were asked about their decision to transfer those units to the Space Force. And both Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall and Space Force Chief General Chan Seltzman, they expressed that that's the path that they're planning on taking. Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall said that they have been looking into the functions of those 14 units performing space missions and how those units fit within both the Air Force and the Space Force. He said that most of the units fit within the Space Force, although a couple of units might fit better into the Air Force. But given that there is a proposed legislation out and the conversations that Air Force officials are having with lawmakers about the possible course of action, it's pretty clear that the path that the Air Force wants to take is to move those units into the Space Force.
And everyone agrees, or is there pushback to how they're planning to do this?
Well, there is an authority that was passed last year. Previously, the Space Force didn't have any work flexibilities and they didn't have any part-time positions. But now, under the Space Force Personnel Management Act, the Space Force can give more work flexibilities to its guardians. So, for example, right now, they're transitioning about 1,000 Air Force reservists with space missions into the Space Force under this act. The act doesn't cover the National Guard, but the intention is to move those people under the Personnel Management Act. And there has been a lot of pushback from guardsmen themselves, since they're concerned that these changes will require them to move to a different place. It will require them to move their families. And just in general, they say that they signed up to serve in the National Guard rather than the Space Force. But Kendall said that no one will have to move and no drastic changes will take place. Let's take a listen to what Kendall said during a Senate hearing yesterday.
We're very grateful that this committee and your colleagues on the other side of the Hill supported the Space Force Personnel Management Act. It allows the Space Force to have full-time and part-time people in it and to be very flexible in how it manages people. So we want to bring these guard units into that same structure. And that's clearly, from the point of view of the Space Force, the best solution. There's no intention to move anyone. So there's some concerns out there that I think are overblown.
And what about the idea of a National Guard component for the Space Force? Another endless debate. Is that still on the table?
Right now, the Air Force is conducting a study on the feasibility and advisability of either creating a separate National Guard for the Space Force, moving all those units to the Space Force, or leaving things as they are. The study is not complete yet, although it was due on March 1st. But Kendall said that it's in its final stages. But given that there is a proposed legislation out and all the remarks that have been made on the Hill in the past 2 weeks, top officials oppose the creation of a separate National Guard component for the Space Force. Here's Space Force Chief General Chan Seltzman on what he thinks about a Space National Guard.
The missions that are currently being performed in the Air National Guard are critical to our success, and I've been very clear about that in the past. The easiest way for me to manage it, though, is for those missions to be performed in a single component. There's an added level of complexity if the Space Force is required to manage a second component, like a Space National Guard. And I'm trying to do my best to keep the administrative bureaucracy, the staffing levels of the Space Force, as small as possible. But in order to take care of those airmen that are currently performing space mission, I would need to have some administrative increases in order to manage two retirement systems, two promotion systems, all of the necessary overhead that comes with a second component.
And some of the states might have something to say about this and the reaction we're hearing from the states where these National Guard units would potentially be housed.
Given that the proposed legislation is trying to go around governors to make changes to the National Guard units, governors have come out against the legislation. Colorado Governor Jared Polis said, and I quote, "I oppose the legislation in the strongest possible terms." The National Governors Association already called for the immediate withdrawal of the proposed legislation. And there is just a wider concern about the precedent that this would set in terms of what the DOD would be able to do or what other missions would the DOD be able to take out of the National Guard moving forward. But here's Frank Kendall's response to those concerns.
This is an artifact of the creation of the Space Force. It's sort of cleaning up the battlefield of the creation of the Space Force, doing what makes sense and logical for this people. It's a legal term, sui generis. It's a unique situation. There's absolutely no intention to make any other changes to moving things out of the Guard.
So just give us a summary here. If this latest piece of legislation were to be enacted, what would happen to Space Force, to the Air National Guard, and to the Air Force?
It would basically allow the Air Force to transfer those 14 units within the National Guard that perform space missions and move them into the Space Force. Again, the way that they would have to go about it is they would have to go around governors in those seven states.
In the seven states where the 14 units are located now.
Correct.
So the states don't want to lose that component that they have, but Kendall says they would still physically stay where they are.
Yes, that is correct.
And is there actual legislation yet in Congress?
So far, it's just the Air Force officials who send the legislation, and lawmakers are expressing concerns about what would happen to the almost 1,000 guardsmen right now. But it's unclear right now.
No sponsor yet for that proposed legislation?
No, not yet.
Federal News Network's Anastasia Obis, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And check out her story at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected. And also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective, we get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down, so I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made. And I realized in my own sense, I wasn't listening to very different opinions. And I probably should have, because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins. who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.